You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. But Don, whether or not you're ready, it's going to be 104.
We're going to have some more weather whiplash. Last week, we talked about how strange the weather was going to be. And indeed, we went up very high and then dropped down relatively cool. And we're going to do that again. Lois and I are preparing this show on September 4th, 2024 for broadcast September 5, 2024. And according to the National Weather Service, today, Wednesday, is going to be 101 degrees with a night temperature tonight, clear 62 degrees. Thursday, heat advisory, 104 degrees and dropping down to a low Thursday night of 64 degrees and Friday, 101 degrees, a little mini heat wave. Very still air out there last night. And if there's any smoke in the valley, any fires around the area, we are going to see some air quality problems for the next couple of days. Friday night will be 61. Saturday dropping down to 94. Here we go, folks. Saturday night, 57 degrees and mostly clear. Sunday, 91 and sunny. Sunday night, mostly clear and 57. Monday, 88. Monday night, mostly clear and 57. Tuesday, 86. And according to Weather Underground, which is usually a little more extreme on their numbers, but according to them, on Wednesday, the 11th, our high temperature will be 80 degrees. So 104 on Thursday, down to 80 degrees next Wednesday in 6 days. September can be one of our warmest months. October can be very warm, and both of them can be quite windy. When I worked at a nursery down there, we would tell people in September, you need, before September, you need to plan for the Santa Ana winds, which are an annual thing down there. Going back to school after Labor Day, north wind, Santa Ana wind coming in off the desert, and you're in this coastal fog belt, it would be quite an extreme thing to experience. And we have that same kind of thing up here. So before we go too much further, I want to answer a question someone asked me. It's September. The days are getting shorter. Should I cut back on my irrigation?
And I said, I don't think so.
In theory, you could, but you'd have to use
The wind.
You'd have to use some judgment. So you can monitor the evapotranspiration rates. And I explained you can go to these sites, the Simis weather sites, and see what the ET rate has been compared to July, for example. But the wind and the low humidity can be a big factor. And in September 2022, we hit 116 degrees 2 days in a row. 2 days after that were 110, and the 3 days after that were 106. That broke records, not just for September. 116 was the highest temperature that had ever been recorded here. So we were breaking records in September, not July, in September. And that was a full week of extreme heat. So you could, in theory, monitor and cut back your irrigation to try to conserve water, but be prepared to bump it back up if a north wind event happens and or we get a spell of very high temperatures, which, of course, anyone who's lived here for a long time has experienced. Also, one other factor, the available water in the soil by September and October is at its absolute lowest ebb for the year. So, yes, the days are getting shorter. Yes, the average ET rate is dropping, but it can spike up very rapidly. And the soil is as dry as it's going to be because we're, you know, that much further from rainfall than, you know, when was the last rainfall? May? Did we even have rain in May? I can't remember now. So you're anything that the plants are getting is what you're providing, unless they're very deep rooted trees. So yes, I do cut back on the frequency of irrigation, but I'm also fully prepared to bump it back up if I see that we're going to have a dry north wind, as we're probably going to have, or if we're having periods of higher temperature. If you are able and comfortable with irrigating based on the actual weather, fine. But September to me is very much like August in terms of what the plants need here. And we've had years where we've had, you know, one north wind event is common, two is pretty common. 4 or 5 years ago, we actually had five north wind events in the 5 weeks of early October through early November, five of them. And on each of those days, at least one day of it, the ET rate was comparable to a July day. So if you were backing off on irrigation, your plants got very stressed. Some of them simply went into dormancy. That's fine, but it can be problematic to try and follow the calendar when in fact what you should be following is the actual water use. If you stuck with your August watering schedule through September, I think it's safer for your plants. I hope that's the best answer.
And listeners, you know Don, he is a nerd when it comes to watering and going out there and looking at the ET rates. And I'll say, you know, there's not many people that are as conscientious as Don.
We want you to be. We want you to be.
As picky as Don. And so if you're more like me than like him, don't change your watering until after we've had a rainstorm.
Well, whenever I've been in retail now for 42 years.
Oh.
43 years. 44 years if you count the time I spent in nursery in Southern California. I have learned one thing. Some people like rules of thumb and other people want to know the science. And yep. If you feel comfortable making judgments based on the ups and downs of the evapotranspiration rate just in the next 10 days, it's going to go way up and way down. Average will be fine, but it's going to be, you know, much hotter as we're speaking today, tomorrow, the next day, and there's going to be some wind, and then we're going to, you know, the wind, the next breeze that comes in is going to drop it down by, what did I say, 20 plus degrees. If you're comfortable making those judgments, fine. It's like trying to decide whether or not to fertilize on a schedule or based on the plant's apparent needs or based on soil tests. Everyone's got a different way of going about things. I think it's not harmful in any way to keep your irrigation pattern at what it's set for August. And perhaps on the 1st of October, reevaluate that. But keeping in mind that October can be a very dry, windy month here as well. Our general experience has been through about mid-October, it feels like summer. Then there's a pretty rapid change. And it's very common. The typical pattern is we get our first rainstorm late October and there's a rapid drop in temperature and you begin to feel more fall-like. That's when I would feel more comfortable with you changing your irrigation schedule. But monitor. This is very important. In the month of July, 2024, this year, water use by plants was 10 to 20% above average. In some periods there, it was 30% above average. And if people were watering what had normally been correctly, it wasn't enough. And we're now, of course, after the month of August, which was very cool and pleasant, we're now looking at samples that people bring in from injury to the plant 4 or 5 weeks previously due to the high temperatures that we were experiencing in July. August was great, folks. Let's keep this in mind. Most of you with tomato plants, if you're anything like me, you've got a whole new wave of them coming on that's set in the month of August, will be ripening here in late September and into October. That's great. Some people, the plants petered out in July. They gave them enough fruit. They weren't watering them enough in most cases because they really did need deep watering. All right, take them out and you'll move on to one of our topics for later in the program, what to plant in September. But we've got PSAs and all that kind of stuff. So go ahead, Lois.
So before we get to all of the questions that we have, and boy, do we have a lot of questions, I want to tell you about a monthly activity which happens here in Davis, which is one of my favorite events. The Friends of the Davis Public Library have a book sale, a 3-day book sale here at the library. It's in the Blanchard Room in the library's on 14th Street. And this Monday, it's Friday, September 6th through Sunday, September 8th. It's always the first Friday of the month and whatever that weekend is. Friday, noon to 5, Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 10 to 3. By the way, Sunday is bag day. When you walk in, they'll hand you a grocery bag and as much stuff as you can put in there, $10 for the whole bag. And there's no limit on bags either. There's a lot of stuff there. And if you have books to donate, don't do it this weekend, but drop them off some other time and give them a chance to get your books incorporated into the sale. The sale is beautiful and it's really well organized and it is huge. So that's always good. And by the way, if the sale's not on and you still want to buy something from the library, they now have a bookstore downtown, Logos Books, which is at 513 Second Street, is run by the Friends of the Davis Public Library, and all of the money there goes to keep the bookstore going and add money to the coffers.
Oh, cool. All right. Let's see. We had another PSA. You were going to mention...
No, you were going to talk about one of the shows.
Oh, yes. All right. I will do that.
Let's talk about your show. We haven't done that in a while.
What, my show? Oh, you mean Jazz After Dark?
Yeah.
Yes. For a number of years now, I've been doing a program called Jazz After Dark. I focus on mid-20th century jazz. It's Tuesdays from 8 to 9 p.m. I don't exclusively do mid-20th century jazz, but that's the big focus. Traditional and mainstream jazz and some of the cool jazz from, and literally cool jazz as they called it at the time, from the 1950s and into the 60s. So if you like old school jazz, that Jazz After Dark is 8 to 9 p.m. There's a option for a podcast. So if you've got your favorite podcast directory, look for Jazz After Dark and you can download it right to your computer.
All right. Well, let's jump right in and get into our mailbag here. By the way, if people want to send us questions or comments, or we love to hear about the good things too.
DavisGardenShow at gmail.com. DavisGardenShow at gmail.com. Your pictures are welcome. Now, there's a picture that I sent to that, which I think we'll start with. As well, we mentioned last week, we suggested mark your calendar for sometime next year to do what I call Helen planting. My daughter's name is Helen. And when she was a little girl, she would and her brother would go out and they'd take packets of seed. Right by the front door is one of those drawers that every house has with all kinds of stuff in it. And that's where we would throw flower seeds and even sometimes flower bulbs and whatever. And they liked to take a packet of seeds in a trowel and go out, sneak out when we weren't watching and plant them all in one place, like a whole packet of seeds. You'd be walking along and your begonia border would have suddenly 25 little green bean seedlings coming up in it. We thought this was cute and amusing. So we would just leave it. And they really like to do it with sunflowers. And one time Helen did it with a sunflower, a whole package of seeds in one place. And they all came up and she showed me. And as I told you last week, I gave her the whole dad lecture. Oh, this is cute, honey, but it isn't going to work because they're too crowded and competition and blah, blah, blah. We'll leave it and see what happens. What happened was they turned into a wonderful bouquet. So dad was wrong. Helen was right. And because of that, every couple of years, I'll do the same thing just for fun. You take a whole packet or 10 to 20 seeds is fine if you feel like that's wasteful to do a whole packet. And you loosen up the soil. And I do it right on an emitter somewhere in my vegetable garden that's already getting watered. And it's a high, pretty high output emitter. Sunflowers grow fast. And I'll plant typically the whole packet, which in the case of retail these days is about 10 or 20 seeds in one place. You can go to the Davis Garden Show page itself on KDRT also. You'll see a picture of this year's Helen planting. And when you do this, they do all come up and they do grow away from each other and they make a big bouquet. And of the 10 or 20, I just went out and counted this morning, there are 8 plants that survive the self-winnowing process, you might say, and they're all coming into bloom right now. So it makes a amusingly spectacular display. And I highly suggest you do this at least once. I use the variety Mongolian Giant or something like that. It's very much like the Russian Giant. And it's done.
But they're not all the same, Don. There's a couple of weird things in there.
Yeah, they were supposed to be the same. This is one that's grown for the seeds. It's grown for roasting the seeds. It's like the Russian Mammoth or the Mammoth Gray, sold by under several different names. The large one that most people grow for roasting seeds. Mongolian Giant appears to be a variant of that, except, yes, indeed, one of them. It's totally different. It's like 3 feet taller than all the others. It's a branching flower inflorescence structure, whereas most of them are a single-headed flower. And it's a different color. So someone mixed up one seed in there, and that does happen.
And then at the bottom of the picture, there's a little tiny sunflower. Does that mean it's just newly come out, or is that a different species also?
That's one that got crowded by the others. So that's demonstrating the competition that does occur. And they're not all the same size. But the other thing I've got to say about this, I've been taking pictures now of all the pollinators that are visiting these flowers. It's September. These sunflowers are blooming. I was just standing there an hour ago taking pictures of 3 different species of bees that were landing as I did it. And very, very active. I got one picture a couple of days ago where a praying mantis had just landed smack dab in the middle of the sunflower and was sitting there waiting for things that she could grab and really well positioned for feeding herself that day. all kinds of things in the evening. I'm out there just at dusk. There's moths coming to them. Sunflowers and anything related to them are outstanding plants for drawing beneficials into your garden, not just pollinators, which are just going nuts on there. European honeybees, squash bees, sweat bees were all visiting these flowers, but also various little wasp things were going in there. And of course the moths in the evening and the mantis is up there. So you've got a little factory for getting beneficials of both kinds, pollinators and things that feed on pests in your garden coming in. So sunflowers are fun. Of course, they're very pretty and you can eat the seeds of many varieties, including this one, but they're great as a cover crop, as a plant to draw beneficials, and just for the fun of growing this giant bouquet in one spot. So mark your calendar, and we want to see your pictures next summer.
How tall is this thing? Is this like, it looks like it's 10 or 12 feet tall.
The tallest one is about 12 feet tall. Yeah, most of the wow. Mongolian giant are mostly in the 8-foot range. When I was a kid, I grew a Russian or gray mammoth sunflower, and there's a picture of me at about 10 or 11 standing on our garage roof holding the thing because it got to be about 14 feet tall and it made a nearly 2-foot diameter flower head. That was in San Diego, and you can do that here too. Basically, the more you feed and water sunflowers, the bigger the plants will get, the bigger your seed heads will be if you're growing them for that purpose. You don't have to do that. Sunflowers grow happily with very limited irrigation. They'll just be smaller. They'll set seeds with just normal garden watering. But if you really want to have fun, go ahead and amend the spot with some manure, give them plenty of water. You will get one of the biggest plants you've ever seen. And they grow very, very fast. See, the year I grew that, I don't know, 14-foot tall sunflower, a guy had come around our neighborhood selling manure, and he had a dump truck of manure. And so my dad said, I'll take the whole thing. Sure. And so he pulled around the back and backed into where he could dump it. And we got, I would say, about like your chip drop load.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, of manure. And it was way more than a normal residential property in coastal San Diego could use in one year in the garden. So it stayed in a pile there for quite a long time and got spread around. And it was very heavily incorporated in the area where that sunflower grew, just demonstrating the benefits of nitrogen in the production of sunflowers. So we gave my dad a hard time about that for a long time. He got a real deal, man.
All right. Next from our mailbag, Ilya writes, hi, Don and Lois. Great episodes always. A quick question in regards to my first year wisteria. I planted it in May this year. The plant took off really well and doubled or maybe even tripled its vines. But now I see a few yellowing leaves on the lower branches. I looked around my neighborhood and found some wisterias perfectly lush green and some totally yellowing. So no real point of reference there. Any chance you could suggest a way to improve? Please see the photo attached. Many thanks in advance from Ilya in Tiburon. P.S. Our soil is very clay heavy. If it needs fertilizers, please suggest which one. And the picture that she sends is a wisteria vine with a few yellow leaves and spots on the edges.
Yeah, and the spots don't concern me. Those are probably just a bacteria that's gotten into a leaf that is yellowing and dying. So they're not the cause. They're just sort of finishing the job. It's a young plant, and it just went in May. And even in Tiburon, it was a very relatively hot July. It was, in fact, quite hot for a lot of Northern California. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that this was most likely irrigation related. It was just a new plant that you couldn't quite give enough water to in one of those 3 or 4 day periods when we had very high temperatures. It's hard for me to imagine needing to fertilize wisteria. They're an extremely vigorous vine, and feeding them would just make them more vigorous. I'm not sure that's necessarily a desirable outcome. I'm guessing you were watering it correctly for a normal July. We started the program with, but it was hotter in July than usual. And at some point it didn't get enough irrigation. I would probably widen your irrigation zone a bit, because very commonly comments we're getting when we ask people how they're watering, they'll talk about the system. And then we'll say, now, we'll just curious, the drip emitters you say are right at the base of the plant. Are there any further down the drip line that might be watering a wider zone? And generally there isn't. So that means that you're only watering part of the root system when you irrigate. If you run it long enough, one of our aphorisms, most problems with drip systems can be corrected by running them longer. So that's a Redwood Barn, a Davis Garden Show aphorism. Most problems with drip systems can be corrected by running them longer. It would spread out by our old friend capillary action. But if you want to enhance that and you're using drip, just add more emitters to a wider zone. If you're doing it with a sprinkler system, sprinklers aren't perfect and they don't distribute real well. And most people don't run sprinklers long enough to get a good depth of penetration with watering. So a separate cycle may be necessary. Using a hose in this instance would probably have taken care of the problem. But the good news is we're seeing a lot of plants in the valley here that are showing signs of late summer stress. And some of them are trees and shrubs that are deciduous. So they're actually like turning a little color, dropping some leaves. That's okay. They're going into sort of an early dormancy and might even put on some new growth while they're doing so. I mean, they're a little confused by the weather we had, and the irrigation was very challenging to figure out with that long period of above average evapotranspiration rates. It's not going to be harmed by this. My guess is it will come back just fine. Nitrogen would make it deeper green, but would also make it more vigorous. And I want people to understand when they are planting a wisteria, it's a very vigorous, large, heavy, woody vine. So when I see, for example, an arbor that's got lattice on it and they're going to plant, you know, thin lattice type stuff on it, they're going to plant a wisteria on that. I say, that's going to just rip apart the lattice. You understand that all a wisteria needs is like a grape, one big 2x4 that you're going to tie it to and keep cutting it back to. You need to be able to get up there wherever it is and prune it back because it becomes extremely overgrown. It's a very, very vigorous and somewhat overwhelming vine. So hopefully you have it in a place where it can do that. I would not encourage that vigor with more nitrogen. I would just water deeper and more broadly and figure it's probably pretty well done with its growth for this season. Could put on another surge as we go in through September and early October, but don't count on it. Don't worry too much about that. And I'm sure it will be just fine. I don't think what you're seeing there is a disease, and it certainly doesn't need any nutrients that I can see evidently.
So Don says it's a vigorous thing. I want you all to know, I this was one of the plants that was here when I moved in, and I didn't notice that it had gone up through the bushes in the back and snuck over to the neighbor's redwood tree until it was flagging off the top of an 80-foot redwood tree. And that's when we all noticed that there was wisteria up there.
Yeah, it can really, I mean, my father was very paranoid about the wisteria that I planted at our house in San Diego. He took it out as soon as I went off to college, but he was very concerned because he said he remembered a house in New York where he was from, where it had swallowed up the house. So they had removed the house and there was a wisteria shaped like a house that was now like a county park or something. He was afraid that was going to happen to the house in San Diego. So I planted a lot of vines in that garden when I was a teenager. And every time I'd go back, you know, I'm up here at school, I go back for the holidays. It seems like another one had disappeared. And he was taking them out one by one. And it was reasonable. One Japanese honeysuckle, wisteria, some of them would have overwhelmed the yard and become extremely high maintenance. So my hope is that you have this planted in a place where it'll be easy for you to train it onto a simple but sturdy structure and get in and prune it once a year to keep it on that structure. Otherwise, it is extremely vigorous and can engulf nearby vegetation, trees, telephone poles, and perhaps your whole house if you let it. Now, I had to ask, you know, how long did it take to swallow up a house, and didn't they notice? But it is a vigorous vine, yes.
So two questions. One is, if I had an old mature wisteria, 20 years old, and I decided to take it out, if I just cut it off at ground level, would that kill the plant, or is this one of those that comes up from the roots?
It comes up, but it's manageable. First of all, wisterias, when you buy them, are grafted, or they should be, because if you grow wisteria from seed, which is very easy to do, it'll grow vigorously, but it'll be 8 to 10 years typically before it flowers. Like many woody vines, it has an actual hormonal phase change it has to go through from juvenile to mature before it will flower. In the case of some vines, we don't want them to go through that phase change. Ivy, creeping fig, they actually, after a number of years in the ground, they do go through that, and then they get vigorous and they flower and they fruit and they become even more of a nuisance. In the case of wisteria, you're growing it primarily for the flowers. So if you buy an inexpensive 1 gallon wisteria sinensis that was grown from seed, it'll be a number of years before you see that plant flower. Mm. So when you go to a nursery, you will be paying a fair bit of money for a grafted wisteria. In fact, they've been kind of hard to get because they're a bit of a hassle for the growers to do. It's grafted just onto seedling. I mean, they start the seeds, they let them grow, they graft on the variety you're buying, whether it's Chinese wisteria, Japanese wisteria, one of the cultivars of those and so forth. They're grafted. If they're grafted, they've used mature wood when they graft. Ah. So it will flower right in the container. That's what nurseries like.
So it tricks the new stuff into thinking it's old.
It's already mature. That's right. And this is done with citrus and other plants, which have that maturation, hormonally controlled juvenile to mature phase issue. And in the case of wisteria, it's kind of important because you don't want to plant a vine and then not, you know, that you're growing for the flowers and have to wait that long for it to bloom. If you cut it down, you're almost surely cutting below the graft union. So what resprouts, if you happen to let it grow, is probably just seedling Chinese wisteria. It's been there long enough, it'll probably flower. But it will come back if something happens, like you have to cut it down for a remodel or something, it will come back. It'll be possibly somewhat different than the cultivar you planted. It may take a while to bloom. It will try to resprout. But generally speaking, my customers who have removed wisteria have found, yeah, you have to monitor, but it's not that big a deal. It's not like a Chinese tree of heaven or privet or some of these other crab apples. A lot of the members of the Prunus genus, you know, the flowering plums, which I have all over my property, coming up both from seed and from rootstock. No, it's not like that. It's just you will need to monitor because here and there it'll pop up now and then. Usually all you need to do is break them off and it doesn't even require a chemical treatment, but you need to keep after them because as Lois can attest, you can recover very quickly.
It's sneaky.
I've gotten to the point where I feel like when someone comes in and asks about a vine, I want to sit them down and tell them about all the mistakes I've made planting vines. My father could tell you some stories. And then, are you really sure you want this? And there are some vines that are well-mannered and less overwhelming and so forth. But wisteria is a big woody vine. Biggest one I ever saw was at Huntington Gardens in San Marino near Pasadena, where we went quite a bit. And it had a trunk the size of a tree. I mean, they are a very, very large plant ultimately. So plan for that as well. It's a woody plant that gets a very large trunk.
I wanted to comment on the picture here, picture of the little yellow leaves and stuff. Well, it turns out that they aren't yellow leaves. They're leaflets on a leaf. So a wisteria has a compound leaf, right, which means there's a central, I don't even know the term, the central thing, off of which come little leaflets. So when the whole thing falls off, don't panic. It's just a leaf drop.
Yeah. Now, this is looking at this picture, this is a fairly typical wisteria that they purchased, which has been wrapped around a post and tied rigorously to the post. Each of those stems, and I count five or six that are tied onto this one stick, each of them is going to try to get quite sizable. So at some point, 2 to 3 years in, you typically do some thinning out. I've actually seen vines strangle themselves where one wraps around another part of the plant, then constricts it. So at some point, you're going to go in there, you're going to take that stake out once it is up on the structure that you have intended for it, which I can't actually see in this picture. And you're going to get down to two or three, maybe even just one eventually. And you'll get to the point where you have your permanent stems, trunks chosen. There's more than you need there right now. So you do a little thinning out perhaps next winter or the winter after, something like that.
Well, one thing you could do already is cut the twine holding it to the stake, untwist those wisteria vines so that they are not going to strangle each other when they grow up. And then you can loosely tie them back to the same stake and they won't be harming each other.
Not right away, anyway. Yeah, in the long run, you'll probably need to thin it down. Or, you know, like my sunflowers, they may thin themselves down. So someone asked me, what is a tree wisteria? Well, a tree wisteria is just a regular wisteria that's been trained that way. There isn't another kind of wisteria that makes a tree. All they've done is they have taken it in the first season, and I had a grower that used to do a really good job on these. They finally went out of business. But train it up to the top as if it were a tree. Top it as if it were a tree, and it sort of lollipops out from that, is the term we use. And then they remove all the suckers and they let it grow for an extra year. That's the reason they're typically rather expensive. Tree wisteria is an amazing garden artifact or contrivance, I guess is the best term I can use. They can be spectacular if you have them in the right place as a real focal point, much like a weeping cherry, that kind of thing. You're going to put it where this is really going to be the focus when it's in bloom. You have to prune them all the time because they try to revert to being a vine. So it's a really high input thing, but they are worth it if you have the right place for them. But it's not a different kind of wisteria. It's a different method of training.
So she could take that wisteria that we have the picture of, and once it gets a couple of years in, the stems will be stiff enough to hold themselves up. Yes. And you could make any wisteria a wisteria tree.
Sure.
As long as you support it while the stem gets thick enough. Yes. What would be about 3 years, you think?
Yeah, and then you're just going to have to plan for doing a pretty hard pruning year after year right after it blooms. And this is the other, I didn't really intend to go on a long thing about wisteria here, but the other thing people ask, can you prune them in the summer? They're running all over the place. Heck yeah, no problem. Don't prune way down into the main branches that you've trained onto your structure, because they mostly flower there. But those summer tails, as I once heard them called, those summer tails that come whipping out and trying to climb onto, I don't know, your neighbor's nearby redwood tree, yes, you can snip those off. No, you're not hurting the plant. It's probably a good thing to do, in fact, to keep it where it's supposed to be. There are two basic types. Why not? Well, let's go on a little bit here. There are two basic types of wisteria. There's Chinese wisteria and Japanese wisteria. They differ primarily in how they flower. The inflorescence of Chinese wisteria, which is the familiar one, is about a foot long. There's purple and white, and there's a pink one as well. And the flowers open all at once on that cluster, pretty much. They open down rapidly down the cluster. So you get an amazing bloom for about 7 to 10 days. And as anyone who's grown wisteria knows, they're very, very fragrant. Japanese wisteria, Wisteria floribunda, has long bloom clusters that go on 2 to 3 feet and hang down. We planted that on an arbor at our first house, and the arbor, fortunately, was 10 feet high. So they would hang down. You'd still be kind of walking through them when they were in bloom. They bloom gradually down the flower cluster. So from the stem end all the way down to the end may take as much as 3 to 4 weeks. You get more bloom. It's never as spectacularly showy as the Chinese wisteria. It's equally fragrant. It just gives you more flowers over a longer period of time. If you do choose to grow the Japanese wisteria, plan for those 3 foot long flower clusters, because if it's just on a trellis, they get all tangled up in the foliage, but they're great for an overhead structure that's at least 10 feet high, so that you're only pushing them out of your way a little bit as you walk through them. They're equally vigorous. Those of you who live back east know there's a native wisteria here in North America, just as vigorous, looks a lot like the Chinese wisteria, does very, very well. All of them can be marginally invasive plants, at least locally, so be cautious where you plant them, but they're very tough and adaptable.
Looking in our mailbag, we have another. This is from Stacy and Davis. I tasted some itty bitty red tomatoes today, about the size of a raisin. Yeah. Maybe like these, and then put in a link to a website. Have you grown tomatoes this small? I'm wondering if you sell them at Redwood Barn or have a recommended variety. I'd love to try growing them next summer. I loved the taste.
And this one was called?
Spoon and currant tomatoes.
Spoon. I have grown both. Spoon is a variant of currant tomato. Currant tomato is a really interesting, it's actually a species. It's just a wild species of tomato. Lycopersicum, now back in Solanum, and it has its own species name. Very easy to grow. The fruit is the size of your little fingernail. They are a very vigorous plant, as vigorous as most cherry tomatoes. So they go out of a 6 foot cage by early July, halfway back down to the ground by August, and they'll be all over the place by the end of the season. My experience with spoon was interesting. Currant tomato, first of all, is one tomato that doesn't pollinate itself. It's an interesting flower structure, which is that the receptive part pushes past the male part. And so the male part's trying to pollinate it and can't because it's out there. It's stuck out further. So it actually requires a bee to bring in pollen from either another flower or another tomato nearby. And if you plant it and you don't have any other tomatoes, there's a pretty good chance you won't get real good yield on them. But my experience with spoon was that it's a heat sensitive variety. So when I grew it, it grew great and it flowered by the bazillions. I mean, you're going, this is just going to be an insane number of fruit. And then they wouldn't set and wouldn't set and wouldn't set during periods of normal high temperature here. So apparently 90 degrees and up, it's not going to set real well. And then at the end of the season, as we cool off, you suddenly have more than you know what to do with. And they are, the name is appropriate. 3 or 4 of them would fit in a teaspoon. They're really cute, little tangy, tart, sweet fruit, and very distinctive, fairly intensely flavored. And they appear to just be a variant of the currant, and I'm not sure how they differ because I haven't grown them side by side. So not super productive mid-season. You get a few fruit early. They grow like crazy. Lots of fruit late in the season. Fun to grow, but it's just for fresh picking. I mean, you're just going to go out there and pick them pretty much right there, given the size of the fruit. I said I have sold currant, and I have sold spoon. If I were choosing between them, I found currant actually produced better than the variety variety called Spoon. So I'll make a point next year of getting some current tomatoes and selling them. It's a vigorous plant. Seems very disease resistant. In fact, it's been an important source of disease resistance being bred into other tomato varieties. So the current tomato is a pretty important one from a plant breeding standpoint. But don't count on a lot of fruit until kind of the end of the season. That's been my experience with them. Fun to grow, definitely. Every year I grow some weird species wild tomato. This year I grew the Galapagos wild tomato. This is a species native to Galapagos Island. So far it has produced two fruit and about 10,000 flowers. So another one that appears to be quite heat sensitive. I've noticed with the late August significant cool down, we got a whole bunch of fruit setting. I also grew Sarah's Galapagos. I don't know who Sarah was, but she went to Galapagos, and these are islands if you aren't familiar with them. Okay, way out in the Pacific off of South America. And Sarah's Galapagos is bigger and has fruited very heavily. It appears to be, according to Wikipedia and other reliable sources, a cross between the wild Galapagos tomato and some other tomato that they don't know what it is. It happened probably on the island there where there are people living and where they grow tomatoes. It's native there. I mean, this is one of the places that tomatoes come from. So her version sets very well. It's a delicious, tangy, small cherry, yellow, bright yellow, very attractive. And has at first, it seemed like it was going the same pattern of flowering, not fruiting. And then it started fruiting very heavily. So if you like this category, the reason I mentioned this, look for, and you'll have to find it in specialty seed suppliers, or perhaps at my nursery next spring, Sarah's Galapagos is going to be more rewarding than the wild Galapagos. Every year I try a couple of new cherry types. I'm not a huge fan of cherry tomatoes, but I've got household members who are, and I want to see if there's something new out there or something really exciting or something that might just be a change from the common Sun Gold and Sweet 100 crowd that everybody likes to grow. Tim's Taste of Paradise is a cherry tomato that Brad Gates of Wild Boar Farms reintroduced this year. It had been lost to the trade for a decade or more. And it is about a 12-foot plant with several hundred fruit on it right now. So it's a very productive one. It has that tangy, sweet combination that people really like in cherry tomatoes. So I probably will carry that one again next year since Wild Boar Farms sells locally here in Northern California, Green Acres Nurseries in Sacramento, some of the other smaller garden centers, and a couple nurseries in the Bay Area. Tim's Taste of Paradise, I'm guessing he'll keep that one in production. Definitely worth growing if you like very large amounts of relatively small, tangy, sweet cherry tomatoes.
Okay. Well, let's see what else we've got in the mailbag. Now, here's a problematic one. This is from Anne, who says, "Hi, I'm up here in Southern Oregon, USDA Zone 8B, and wanting to plant some Panicetum?
Panicetum is how I learned it.
Panicetum. Yep. Little bunny in a mass planting. We have insanely hot summers and cool but not cold wet winters. The area I want to plant is clay with good drainage and is southeast facing with full sun all day. The question is, if I plant and establish this fall and winter, could I get away with not irrigating them if I also added a deep layer of wood chips as mulch? If not this variety, is there another mounding ultra xeric grass that might meet my desires? As usual, I appreciate the Lois and Don team."
So that's USDA Zone 8B. That was the first thing I need to check was whether that particular Panicetum is hardy there, and it does appear to be. You have hot summers, but ours are hotter.
What is Panicetum, Don? I'm not familiar with that name.
Let me see if I can find a common name. Most people know the feather grass. Let me see.
It's a grass. Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, this is a grass, and it's got really, really pretty fluffy flowers. And most people here are growing the red-leafed Panicetum, Cetaceum cuprium.
She said Panicetum little bunny, and little I was bunny. Thinking, well, was it mule's ears or something? No,
let's see if we can give you a common fountain grass. There we go. Now, there are Panicetums that are highly invasive. I want to throw that out there right away. Panicetum orientale and some of the others have proved to reseed, and we don't want people planting them. Some of them are on invasive plant list. Some of them should be. This one is not invasive. Neither is the red-leafed type that's so popular here. It would take your summers with no problem. Good rule of thumb for grasses is perennial grasses. They need 20 to 30 inches of rainfall in order to make it through a year without irrigation. We don't get reliably here 20 to 30 inches of rainfall. So There are grasses that are more xeric, that are more drought tolerant, but they mostly have a pretty substantial summer dormancy. Our native grasses, for example, mostly rather brown looking at this time of year if they're unirrigated. But you're in a rainier climate. So if you get 25 to 30 inches of rainfall and you've got the plants well established, any mulch around them, yes, you could probably get them through a normal, whatever that is in your area, summer without too much difficulty. Or if you could just irrigate once or twice as you get late in the season and they're showing any kind of stress. But the worst that'll happen with most grasses as they experience drought is they begin shedding outer leaves first and dying back to the crown. And as long as the growing point is still alive in there, and you can check this yourself very easily, a clump of grass can look dead. You can get in there and tease it apart and pull out a little piece and see whether there's still green and firm down in the crown. Then that grass can come back from even severe drought. What happens to turf grasses, fescues, for example, if they get drought stressed, they'll look rough and you'll think, oh, they're dying. Well, they are, but they're doing it in a systematic and staged manner. So yes, some of the roots are dying back, more to the point, many of the leaves are going to shed, but as long as they still protect that crown of the growing point, which is down in the center of the plant, and you've got the soil mulched around them with your mulch to help keep the roots from dying back, very likely it would get through the summer. I don't know what the appearance would be in your area. Here, if you left Pennisetum little bunny unirrigated through the summer, by now, by September, it would be looking very rough. But I'm almost sure it would still be alive. It just wouldn't be very aesthetic. And we keep in mind when we're talking about drought tolerance of landscape plants, does it compromise its appearance enough that you wouldn't want the plant? Or is it something that you'd be, okay, it made it through, now it's pushing back out. So it is cold hardy. You probably get enough rainfall to do what you're suggesting. Mulching around them would be fine. I will mention, though, my experience planting grasses in the fall is not as good as my experience planting grasses in the spring or early summer. Here, I have found that when I take grasses out and I plant them at the start of the rainfall season, there's a higher propensity to rot. And when I plant them at the beginning of their growth cycle, in many cases, depends on the species, and there's been some variability with this, but when I plant them in April or May and irrigate them well, they take beautifully. And the growers have found the same thing. I mean, my growers' best quality ornamental grasses come into my nursery in early summer. Early to mid-summer. And people are thinking, is this a good time to plant? I said, this is really from the life cycle of this plant in our area. Yes, this is a great time to plant them. So if you're doing hundreds of these, I'd be concerned about your soil being waterlogged in the wintertime and the plants possibly rotting. If you have reasonably good drainage, which didn't sound like, if you have reasonably good drainage, they'd probably come through and then take off. And they'd probably be well enough established that you could back off on the irrigation. But it would be best if you have a plan for irrigating so this you don't go to a lot of expense and effort and then find it isn't working. It could be as simple as a couple of big area rain birds or, you know, impulse sprinklers. I use these a lot on my farm where you just let it goes back and forth over a large area. You let it run for a couple of hours and you do that every 3 to 4 weeks just to keep them alive. Or you go by the appearance, vigor, performance of the plant. Remember, plant performance is your best guide to irrigation. Consider doing that just so you have an option so that you don't go to a lot of trouble and then find it didn't actually work because you didn't get enough rainfall that year and so forth. So fall is okay for planting. It's obviously widely considered to be the best time for planting a lot of things, but I have had problems with grasses rotting when I try to do them right before the rainy season. Now, our soils are pretty dense here, so you may have better soil in terms of water percolating away from the crown of each plant after a heavy rainstorm than we do. I don't know for sure. That was a lot of hedging there. Give it a try. Plan for how to irrigate. The plant should be fine. There's lots of other grasses, by the way, that would also work. And one thing I do suggest, even with you want sort of the uniform meadow look, it isn't a bad idea, just as with everything else. We tell you about hedges and trees and stuff. Diversity is a good insurance policy. So if there's a taller grass you like the look of, having some of that a little further out in the view in one part of the mass area, if there's lower tufty things like some of the fescues that you like, having some in the foreground. That way, if one of them doesn't work out for one reason or another, the others are still there. So it's just hedging your bets is one thing to consider.
Now, you said, or she said, that it's South Oregon. I am wondering if there isn't a university up in that area that might have an arboretum or a display garden or someplace that you could go and see what's doing well and see how they're watering and stuff. And just another little input.
The one I'm aware of, or the place, obviously one of the best horticulture programs in the country, is at Oregon State University. But that's Corvallis, which is a rather different climate. If you're driving down Highway 5, I'm told there's an amazing botanical garden at the base of the bridge in Redding. And I've never stopped at it, but if someone go there, please, and tell me if they have a nice display of ornamental grasses. You want something that can take heat? Redding is the place to go check it out.
Oh, yeah.
Respect to someone in Southern Oregon, closer to your rainfall patterns than something you might find further down into California. But yes, seeing what's working locally, there's lots of grasses that would work. And there's undoubtedly some, you know, Oregon produces most of the turf grass seed for North America. I mean, there are grasses that do extremely well there. I'm not just talking turf grass. They grow all kinds of seeds up there. You have a lot of choices up there. But yes, I think this Pennisetum would work fine.
I want to plant some native grasses this fall, our listener writes. What are other grasses growing here? How do I tell them apart to weed out the non-native ones?
You can't.
A grass is a grass.
Well, there are differences in the seedlings. You would have to get out a key to know what your native seedling grasses look like. This has come up because of people concerned also about foxtails. Foxtails are going to come up with the rains. They want to know if they can tell them from the native grasses in that area. In general, foxtail blades are going to be wider. I mean, that's the one thing I can tell you. Distinguishing grass seedlings is extremely challenging. So what you do is you work on the population, not the individuals. And this, by the way, is a good way to look at the weed problem as well. You're not trying to save every native grass and get rid of every non-native grass. You're trying to shift the population so it's a higher percentage of native grasses. So you seed in your natives, and they need to go on open soil, not onto stuff. There can't be straw or stuff down there. You need to rake out what's there, just like with poppies. You need to rake it out, get down to soil, and scatter the seed right before a rainstorm is ideal. And scatter it at about a pound per 100 square feet if you're really going for high density, pound per 300 square feet if you want to save a little money. So somewhere in that range. And the rains come along and you do some watering if you have to, especially if the north wind blows and all this grass comes up and it looks exactly the same to an untrained eye. And then you just see what develops. And as it grows, when it flowers, of course, it'll be very easy to tell it apart next February, March, April, depending on the species. At that point, you can pretty readily tell the native grasses from the non-native ones, particularly oats and foxtails and things like that have very recognizable seeds, which then turn into flowers, which then turn into the very recognizable seeds. And at that point, it's also a lot easier to pull them out. Because as we've told you many times, as a grass plant is going into bloom, typically its roots are dying back, particularly if it's an annual grass. So they have a growth cycle early in the season. Try and pull up a wild oat or a native grass on your property in October, November, December. It will give a lot of resistance. Its roots are quite extensive, especially by about January, February. It'll just break off in your hand. But as little as 6 to 8 weeks later, once it goes into the flowering stage and you see those flower scapes beginning to come up, you can tug and it'll come out more easily. And once the flowers are actually developing, it'll often pop right out. Oats are extremely easy to pull out when they're in bloom. They're very hard to pull out in the first 2 to 3 months. So that's the first thing, is you're trying to change the population. You're not trying to get rid of every non-native grass individually, because that would be impossible. But once you recognize them coming into bloom, pulling the ones that you know are not native and leaving the others is a good plan. Timing your mowing, by the way, can make a big difference. On my property, I have about a half acre, which was in native grasses when we moved here, and we've worked really hard to keep it in native grasses. The guy who we've bought the farm from had never sprayed glyphosate or any broad spectrum herbicide, just by chance, not because he was that kind of a farmer. And so he had never wiped out everything on the property. He had just sprayed herbicides where he needed them for certain things. So about a half acre plus was basically native grasses being encroached on by foxtail barley, wild oats, mustard, and some of the other invasive or non-native or adventive grasses. So I have found that the native grasses on my farm flower and form seed, which develops before the non-native grasses do. So if I wait until the native grass has gone to seed and then mow, I'll increase the population of the native grasses and gradually decrease the population of the non-native grasses. And that's how I've largely kept the invasive, adventive, non-native grasses out of that one area where I have the natives. It's been an ongoing battle, though. I can tell you that oats want to colonize. They want to crowd out the other things. Foxtail barley wants to colonize and crowd out the other things. So the timing of the mowing can help. Pulling them when you recognize them as being undesirable, particularly foxtails, things like that, can be helpful up to a point, depending on the size or scale of your property. And then just keep seeding in the good stuff until you have a population that's predominantly native grasses. And that'll be a 3 to 4 year process, has been my experience, has been that getting out the ones that want to crowd out your natives can take a couple years, but you can be persistent and you can actually do it. The thing about oats, why this is a problem, oats, when they're going into flowering stage, are 3 to 5 feet tall and they have wide leaf blades and they're very dense. So they shade out everything that's underneath them. In fact, oats are a very effective way to shade out weeds and non-desirable grasses. Unfortunately, they also shade out our native grasses. And that's why our rolling golden hills of California, as a rather famous song says, the golden hills aren't predominantly native grasses anymore. They're almost entirely oats and barley and things like that, because those have gotten taller and have wider blades and can shade out the lower native bunch grasses. So it takes some work. It takes some pulling as they go into bloom, not in the seedling stage, and some careful timing of mowing. And with respect to city or county maintenance of parks and things like that, their timing of mowing can make a huge difference. It's whether they're encouraging native grasses or encouraging, unfortunately, non-native species. That's difficult for them to manage. That's one of the reasons that foxtails can become such a problem in marginal areas of city and county parks, is just the timing of the mowing. You can do is just figure out which are which as they go into the flowering stage, and that's your best time to try and separate them out.
So this one didn't come in the mailbag. This one came because Don is always out there looking at stuff. And he came back and sent me this fall bulb planting schedule. And what it is a very nice map of the United States. And it's got Alaska tucked in there on the side. And it has when to plant fall bulbs. So fall planted bulbs, in the north area, in the northern part of the central United States, is late September and October. And then there's a band that goes through a little bit below that, mid-October and November. And then there's another little band that sneaks across there, across the top of Texas and across up to Washington, D.C., and to plant November and December. And then there's this little blue area. It's Florida, the Gulf Coast, so Louisiana and Texas, and California and the bottom of Arizona. And it says, And you plant your fall bulbs in December.
Yeah.
Don, what are fall bulbs? And
do we have to follow? Right? Do we have to follow this rule? We used to have a problem with our wholesale bulb supplier shipping our big display to us in August. That's a little early. So in California, we're warm through September, through October, and even into November. They do have a pretty good rule of thumb on that little graphic that I sent you about the soil temperature. So we often talk to you about soil temperature for planting warm season things in the spring. Mm-hmm. Well, their suggestion is that 55 degree soil temperature or below is what you should be looking at to plant what they're calling fall bulbs. In the fall, we plant tulips, hyacinths, daffodils, grape hyacinths, wood hyacinths.
They're all not all the same,
crocus,
though.
Freesias, ranunculus, I could go on and on. They're not all the same. And I think that's a reasonably good rule for tulips. And of course, as I know from working with the bulb companies that I work with, ones in Michigan, ones in Connecticut, tulips are their big thing. I mean, most places where people plant bulbs, you walk in and see a display, that's what the big display is going to be. This isn't really tulip country here. California tulips going into warm soil won't develop real well. And so if you plant them too early in soils that are still 60, even 70 degrees, they'll start to root, they'll struggle a bit, the plants will get off to a poorer start, and they will bloom. If you plant, let's say, 50 of them, they won't all bloom together. That's the other thing, is they won't all bloom the way people seem to want their tulips, which is all at once. it's not my deal, but you know, if you're doing a display garden, you want them all to bloom the same week, apparently. So in order to achieve that, there's been a recommendation for years, put your tulip bulbs in the refrigerator for 4 to 6 weeks.
I've heard that.
And then plant them out. And you know what that does? That pushes you into November for planting them, first of all. So you're buying them in September, October. Ooh, put them in the refrigerator 4 to 6 weeks. Try not to forget they're in there. Put a little sign on the bag, do not eat these. And then 4 to 6 weeks later, you're getting into the time when the soil temperature is where it needs to be. I can tell you, you don't actually need to put those bulbs in the refrigerator for 4 to 6 weeks. But if you plant tulips in particular, and hyacinths to some degree, into soil that's warm, such as we have here all the way through October, they won't develop as well or as evenly, and they won't bloom together as they would if you just waited longer. So we don't tell you that you need to refrigerate the bulbs. That's fine if you want to do it. That gets a more uniform bloom cycle. This is tulips and hyacinths and the large flowered crocus, likewise. You don't actually need to put them in the refrigerator, but you do want to wait for them until the soil temperatures are below 55, which in our area is early to mid-November. And December, it's great. In fact, December is when I generally plant my bulbs. And I've done it all the way through January with very good results. So the soil is cool. The soil is workable. It doesn't have to be in perfect condition. I've done plenty of mud planting of bulbs. I have some leftovers from my garden center. I'll just take a trowel out, shove it into the sloppy glop that is a muddy soil, drop the bulb in there, push the glop back over it. Comes up just fine. So they don't really need perfect drainage, and the soil doesn't have to be perfectly workable. But for tulips, hyacinths and giant crocus, it should be cooler than it usually is here in October or even into earlier mid-November. So I agree with their chart for those three categories. Read the bottom line on that chart.
All daffodils contain the alkaloid lycorine, which makes them unpalatable to deer and rodents.
Correct. So also gophers, which are rodents, do not eat daffodils. The line above that says,
notable exceptions for the planting chart, bearded iris and daffodils do not require cooling.
Right. Bearded irises, you can just dig up, divide in July or August, clean them up, put them right back in the ground, or hold them for a couple months and plant them whenever you want to. Daffodils, you don't have to worry about the soil temperature. So if you're at one of those places that's getting their bulbs in early, because they still send them out to a lot of places in September, Costco has bulbs now, you know, ridiculously low prices. It's fine to plant those. Or just store them and plant them later. They're also fine planted later. The only ones where it really matters in terms of soil temperature are tulips, hyacinths, and the giant flowered crocus. Old-fashioned species crocus, fine anytime. Daffodils, fine anytime. We will definitely talk. We will definitely talk more about bulbs. So that's not the entire Davis Garden Show treatise on the subject of bulbs. We're bulb lovers here. And if you've got questions about bulbs and things like that, where to plant them, when to plant them, which ones do best in California or elsewhere, davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
Hey, Don, you know what this weekend is? It's the African Violet Society plant sale. And it's going to be at the McKinley Avenue, the garden...
Shepherd Garden and Arts Center on McKinley Boulevard.
Thank you. And it's going to be Saturday and Sunday, the 14th and 15th.
Yeah, well, you're over there, pick up a couple of piscias for me and maybe a gloxinia. That'd be great. All right.
So we are ending our shows with little sayings or aphorisms or whatever. And this quotation is from Elizabeth Lawrence. The garden year has no beginning and no end.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.